session number 16487, reel 3.
Dr. Frankel, reel 3.
Our camp leader was Prince Wilhelm, the son of the Kaiser's son, so the grandson of the former German Kaiser. He was a tall, typically Prussian-looking young man, very nice, very charming, very much concerned with the welfare of all the internees, which were largely Jewish. And he was really a great chap who took a great deal of interest in the individual internee, and I think helped many. He was very popular. And in fact, this man whose life I saved, this diabetic, who was a very good painter, painted his portrait in the camp, which was very good. The tragedy about Wilhelm was that he was engaged to one of the Guinness daughters and married her, and unfortunately, after the war, committed suicide in Germany. He was found under one of the Rhine bridges. I can't understand why he did this, but while I knew him, and I spoke to him quite a few times, he was a very, very nice, charming man.
And the living conditions?
The living conditions were very good. They gave us prison clothes with a big circle on the back, woolen underclothes. I had no clothes there, except for the suit I wore on that Sunday. They gave us all boots and clothes and very good food. The internees organized entertainment, lectures. There were very many very clever people there. There were lectures and concerts and plays. And I worked in the hospital. We inoculated everybody and looked after the sick. If the ones who were really ill had to go to hospital in Quebec. And they were very good to me because we had contact with the city hospitals and they allowed me to go into the hospitals to visit without a guard. So I could go into the town myself without a guard. They took me by car. So I felt really quite free.
Why did you go to those hospitals?
Well, to see them because out of interest, and also to visit some of our internees who were there, the patients.
Did the attitude of the civilians of Quebec change?
Well, we had very little contact with them. The people in the hospital were perfect. They, by that time, knew who we were. Our camp commandant was a captain who, of course, knew perfectly well who we were. And I've often spoken to him, you see. He knew. And of course, I was one of the very first who returned to England. Do you mind if
Do you mean that the only camp you stayed in Canada was Quebec, or you didn't go to any other camps?
No. We stayed in Quebec until about November. And then we were moved to another camp at, I think it was called Frederickstown, which was near Halifax. And then we moved to Halifax before we were transported back to England. There were about, not many, only perhaps 30 in the first transport back to England.
How did conditions at Frederickstown compare with Quebec?
Well, that was winter when we got to Frederickstown. That was very cold, Canadian winter. But they looked after us. We had camps and huts. Of course, there was a stove going all the time. And we had to provide our own wood. Saw wood to get into the stoves, to fire the stoves. It was very cold. And we wore these extraordinary clothes, you see, the prisoners. We were prisoners still. I mean, I showed you the photograph there.
Can you describe the clothes?
Well, there were overalls, really, with a big red circle on the back. And they gave us thick woolen pants and socks and boots. We were warmly dressed, but must have looked very, very strange.
Did you also function as a physician there?
No. Well, there were only very few of us, you see. Nobody was ill. It was on the way back. The transports had all to be organized, so we went from one place to another until the ship was in place, and then we were moved onto the ship.
So at Frederickston, you were just in transit?
Yes, in transit, yes. Stayed about a week, I'd say. Or may have been 2 weeks.
Did they tell you that you were going back to Britain?
Yes, oh yes.
How did you feel about that?
Very happy. That was extraordinary. You see, we knew the Battle of Britain had been fought. We knew the Low Countries had been overrun. We knew France was defeated. We knew German army stood on the channel ports. And yet, every one of us wanted to go back to England. Every one of us, we were pressing that we wanted to go back. Because we felt, if England falls, the life for us wouldn't be worth living. And I can assure you that was the genuine feeling here. Very strong feeling like that.
And what was the return journey like?
Well, we were in convoy, and we were on a Polish ship. The only passengers, it was remarkable, really. There were these few people, all on this Polish merchant ship. They treated us like passengers. We had dinner, you know, cabins. We were first-class passengers. It was quite unbelievable.
Was it a Polish crew?
Yes, I think so. Yes.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
No, I can't remember the name of the ship. But they treated us like first-class passengers. It was quite remarkable. They chartered the ship, put it out at the disposal of these returnees, and transported us back to England. It was really almost out of this world.
Did you run into the enemy on the way?
No. We saw the destroyers, you know, backwards and forwards, but there was a convoy. But there was no enemy action.
Which month would this have been?
December.
1940?
Yes.
Where did you eventually arrive?
Liverpool. We landed one evening, and there was an air raid going on. We had to wait until it was over, and then they put us ashore, gave me a railway warrant to London, which I had to say where I wanted to go, off you go. And I went to London, arrived in London, at sort of midnight, while there was an air raid on there. Because I hadn't experienced an air raid. Oh, did I? No, not really. The first winter of the war was really quiet, you see. There was very little air. We had the sirens, but no mark. There was no air raid before I went, so when I got back, you just got into the middle of an air raid straight away.
Were you now a free man or still an internee?
Absolutely free.
When had you become a free man?
As soon as I left the ship. Well, I was really free when I got onto the ship, because we were treated like first-class passengers there.
Did you then look for a job?
Yes, I immediately reported to my arrival to the police, and I went then got in touch with the medical superintendent of the hospital at Romford, and he said, "How soon can you come back?" He was very, very pleased to hear my voice, and I said to him, "Well, I'll come back as soon as I can. I must get permission first from the Home Office, which I obtained. And then I went straight back to my job. I got back there, I think, in February.
What were your responsibilities now at Romford?
Well, that was, of course, the war, you see. We were now in the second year of the war. And there were a shortage of doctors, and I was very, very busy. I mean, so busy as no doctor would be nowadays. I had about 120 beds to look after. I had to do casualty, I had to do anesthetics, I had to do fevers, I had to do skins. I mean, I literally worked, I should say, 18 hours a day. Very busy. And I must say that the people who received me back were all pleased to see me. They received me, you know, with great friendliness and understanding. And in fact, some of them have remained my very close friends, although they are by now gone, you see. They're dead.
How had your parents now been faring in London?
Well, they just survived. I mean, my father had this job, you see. He got, I think, around £3 a week or something. And my mother, they lived in the same house, and they let rooms. So they survived. I must say, you see, as I said to you, my father was a prosperous man. We had a good, very good life. You've seen the house where we lived in. And he never complained. He was a proud, very proud man, and a good man. And he taught me a lot when I was a boy. But the life he had to lead here, you'd think he would worry or complain, but he never complained. He was very proud that he helped himself, that he could support, you know, contribute to his support. He was a wonderful man.
Was the hospital bombed in Romford?
Yes, indeed. I was almost killed there. The hospital bungalow where the doctors lived, which was a very modern, beautiful bungalow, one Sunday night, all the doctors had gone to the wards to work, and I was left behind. And at the last minute, I thought to myself, I'll go too, because I didn't want to sit here by myself. And I'd just gone over to the hospital when there was a loud explosion. Didn't know where it was, but obviously very near. And then, after a few minutes, the telephone rang, said, "Was I there, Dr. Frankel?" And yes, I said, yes. So they said, well, they just bombed the quarter, medical quarters at the hospital, completely destroyed. Three bombs had come down. But that was the only time the hospital was bombed. They completely destroyed. We had to give up the quarter. It was a great pity, because it was a very, very nice. Very nice building for the doctors.
Was this in 41?
Yes, yes. It was a cluster of bombs came down.
How long did you stay in this job?
Well, I stayed at Wanstead. At Old Church Hospital until October 1942, when I moved to Wanstead here, and joined the Emergency Medical Service, EMS it was called, which was a senior job, a physician's job.
What was the Emergency Medical Service?
Well, as there were so many doctors in the army, they had to organize doctors working in civilian hospitals. And there were several grades of these doctors, physicians or junior doctors or senior doctors. And I was, this job here at Wanstead Hospital was a job paid for by the ministry under the Emergency Medical Service. It was a hospital job, but paid for not by the local authorities, but by the state, by the Ministry of Health, probably. And I was appointed. I applied for it because it was a senior job.
What kind of duties did you have?
Well, I was a physician there. And of course, I had about 75 medical beds and clinics, outpatient clinics. And of course, one was responsible, children's beds I had. One was responsible for air raid casualties, of course. Which was this hospital, outskirts of East London, we had a lot of casualties here in this area. This house was bombed, was not destroyed, but was damaged. There were a lot of damage around here. Houses all over the place were damaged here. We had all the flying bombs here, you see, they came over here.
We're talking about the Snaresbrook area, we should say.
Yes, yes.
Was this work just as hard as it had been in Romford?
No, not quite as hard, because I did... See, here I was a physician, a senior doctor, whereas there I was a junior doctor. You see, while I was at Old Church Hospital in Romford, I obtained my London Doctor of Medicine degree, and I also became a member of the Royal College of Physicians. I did that study work while I was doing all this heavy medical work. I was successful in that. And in fact, it was quite a funny story here. I worked there almost, got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and did studied, you see, for these examinations. And one morning at 6 o'clock, somebody knocked at my door, and there was the medical superintendent. And he looked in. And he said to me, "Oh, that's the reason why our electricity use in this block is so high, because I got up at 5 o'clock on a winter's morning and put on an electric fire, you see, because otherwise I couldn't have studied." So he checked up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then he said to me, "Oh, well, you carry on." And I got my higher qualifications there, you see.
Which higher qualifications were there?
London Doctor of Medicine, MD, and the membership, MRCP. So I was qualified to take on a physician's job.
Did you do the job at Wanstead to the end of the war?
Yes. I did it until the end of the war. And then I volunteered for military service immediately. I mean, they wouldn't have released me. They wanted me to stay here until the end of the war, because somebody had to do this work. But as soon as the war was over, I volunteered for military service.
Why did you do that?
Well, there were quite a few doctors who didn't join up from the Emergency Medical Service, because they were quite content to stay in civilian jobs. But I just felt I ought to do it. I had no hesitation. I just had to do it.
And did you get in easily?
Oh, yes. I volunteered. I had a medical examination, and I was accepted.
In what capacity?
I was a graded specialist, they called it, in the army. Which meant for the... See, it was a graded specialist. I went in for the rank of lieutenant, and after a year was promoted to major.
Which unit were you in?
Royal Army Medical Corps.
Where did you serve?
Well, I served... I was almost immediately posted to... to Egypt, where did I go at first? No, I was posted to Iraq, that's right, to Iraq, near Basra, so where all this war went on, you know, recently. I was there in the desert at a place called Shaiba, which is about 30 miles north of Basra, one of the hottest areas in the world. And I was OC commanding the medical unit there, which was a very difficult job because all the doctors who were out there, it was a big hospital, which was specializing in treating heat stroke and heat exhaustion. And these doctors couldn't cope with this, you see. They were, you know, they found it too hot. And I had a very busy time keeping the place going, because many of them had to be sent back home, you see. So the temperature there was incredibly high, 140 degrees, you know. It was there in the summer. Very 1946. So I kept the place going. But it was very interesting.
How did you deal with the heat stroke cases?
Well, they had it was a special department built under the ground, you know, deep down, with refrigerated. And you had to keep them, of course, it depended on whether it was heat stroke or heat exhaustion. It was specialized treatment. I mean, heat exhaustion, you had to treat them. They had lost a lot of fluids. You had to give them intravenous fluids. With heat stroke, you had to cool them. A specialized unit there, but otherwise we treated mostly, well, there were soldiers, you see, dysentery, amoebic, malaria, quite a few tropical diseases, and there were Indian soldiers and soldiers from Poland, you know, quite a mixture. It was quite an interesting job.
And then after Shaiba?
After Shaiba, I was posted to Egypt, so I moved across the whole of Iraq by land, you know, by bus. There was a bus called Nairns, an organized bus route, went right across through Jordan, Iraq, Jordan, Palestine, because Palestine was still Palestine, you see, not Israel, and then to Egypt, across the canal. And then I was posted to Alexandria.
To do what?
There, again, officer commanding a medical division. And that was a big hospital, beautiful place in the desert. You know, beautiful in the sense that it was well established. And they looked after us very well there, and the work was also very interesting. In fact, we had to look after the German POWs, and I think I must have, in those days, it wasn't known that you could get bone marrow through a needle, which you stuck into the bone marrow and sucked it out for diagnostic purposes. And I think I must have been the first person in Egypt who did this, to diagnose leishmaniasis, which is a tropical disease. It was quite a dramatic thing. The Germans produced this soldier, and they didn't know what was wrong with him, and I did this. And we had a girl there from Scotland, a pathologist. She made some beautiful slides showing the bone marrow full of these Leishman Donovan bodies, diagnosing this disease.
How did you get on with the German POWs?
Well, it was rather strange. You see, I was in charge of the medical division, and some of them had to be repatriated, you see, and they depended really on our recommendation, a specialist being a specialist. But, you know, I felt very, obviously, not very friendly to them. In my own mind, knowing what's been going on, but I managed to, to suppress that, and I just treated them like one would treat anybody as a doctor.
What impression did they make on you, these men?
Well, I must say I had very little personal contact with them. But I would say, on the whole, they were just ordinary people, like ordinary soldiers. They weren't in any way arrogant. They had a special block for German officers. And once a month I had to go there to go round these wards with the German medical officer. And this I disliked intensely, because there you saw all these old Africa Corps German officers, you know, their faces. And I disliked that intensely, to have to do that, to see these people.
Were they different from the
Yes. Soldiers? Oh, yes. I mean, if you looked at a group of Englishmen and a group of these Germans, I mean, the kind of expressions and facial physiognomy, to me anyhow, was obnoxious. They were prisoners of war, of course, and miserable. But nevertheless, to me they looked nasty.
Did you speak to the Germans in English or in German?
Oh, in English. In English. They wouldn't know that I was German, you see. That was, of course, a very odd situation. No, I wouldn't speak to them in German.
Which years were you in Egypt?
I was in Egypt for 14 months. 1946. And at the end of beginning of 1947, I returned to the United Kingdom, and I was posted to Colchester Military Hospital, where again I was officer commanding the medical division, until I was demobilized. I came out in December 1947 and immediately became physician at Wanstead again.
Did you ever receive any help as a refugee in Britain from any refugee organization or any other organization?
No.
Do you think that would have helped if you had?
I wouldn't have liked it. You see, I wasn't in need of it. You see, I just had enough. I can't remember. I had very little money, but I lived very poor. My room, as a student, was just a, you know, tiny little room, just a bed and nothing else in it. And it was very cheap. And I cooked my own food. I bought food in the markets and had meals in the workmen's dining rooms, you know, that sort of thing. I just had enough money, but I wasn't dependent on anybody. And I hated being. I always was very independent. I wouldn't have liked to be assisted.